From Nevada Public Radio, I'm Paul Boger. This is State of Nevada. Nevada has long been the only state in the U.S. where someone can legally purchase sex. And earlier this year, the majority of the workers at one of the state's oldest brothels, Sherry's Ranch in Pahrump, filed a petition to unionize with the National Labor Relations Board. They're looking to become the United Brothel Workers. This historic first would affiliate them with the Nevada-based Communications Workers of America Local 9413. The movement began in December, when management presented workers with a new contract. It would grant management perpetual control over workers' intellectual property and creative product. Well, that sparked a backlash. To learn more, I'm joined by Jupiter Jetson. She's a brothel worker and union organizer. Jupiter, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Let's dive in. Why do you think this union is needed?
Such a broad question. I guess the bullet points, the shortest answer would be that as workers, we need the right to decide the way that we work. We need agency over our images, agency over our intellectual property, especially in an age where our image and our intellectual property is our future.
So let's, you know, come back to that. You know, what are you hoping to achieve? What are your demands for a better workplace then?
Well, our demands are fairly simple. We, of course, want the agency to have a say in our contracts. We want a safe workplace like any other laborer is entitled to. And we want security. We want, the knowledge that we, as workers, have a safe and secure workplace, just like any, if a coal miner can have it, why can't we?
Do you feel unsafe in your workplace?
I feel like there is a lot of room for improvement in the safety and security standards.
Okay. So when did you first start thinking about this effort to unionize?
So the thing is it We unionized in the oldest tradition of labor organizing, in that we had an unprecedented problem, and as a community, we stepped up together to address it. Mind you, there were workplace issues that we had swallowed for years before this: wage theft, tip theft, in the form of limo fees and tip splits. But we had always just kind of swallowed those issues. But in December, these contracts, it cannot be overstated just how egregious they were. They were demanding all intellectual property, past, present, and future, the rights to our name, our image, our likeness. And to top it off, I think most concerningly, they were demanding the right to our perpetual power of attorney, paired with an interest, which would have meant that power of attorney, the right to sign our signature as if they are us, would have survived not just our employment at the ranch, but also would have carried on past our death, because it was tied to their financial interest in that signature. So, these are a violation of basic autonomy. It's really the rentification of the human experience, so we read these contracts and realized that nobody in their right mind could sign these. And so we started pushing back. We started first emailing management. And when management failed to respond, reaching out to attorneys, other organizations, until eventually we were led to the communications workers. But this really just started as an effort to maintain our autonomy, our dignity, and our futures.
Since the vote to unionize in February, management has fired several workers. What is their reasoning?
They have yet to provide an official reasoning as to why they would fire seven women now who have no history of behavioral or disciplinary action, who have all had exemplary careers at the ranch. It does all seem to coincide with our union activity. And there was no other incident that could explain seven separate firings in the span of 2 weeks.
Jupiter, we have just about 30 seconds left. What are the next steps for you and the union?
The next steps for us are to get to the negotiating table and to start pushing for, the future we want in the Nevada brothel industry.
All right. Jupiter Jetson is a brothel worker and union organizer. Jupiter, thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you. Have a great day.
As a note, KNPR did reach out to management of Sherry's Ranch, but did not receive a response. A spring heat wave is already melting this year's dismally bad snowpack in the Colorado Rockies, and new projections show that only a quarter of the normal amount of water will flow through the river this summer. What does it all mean for the Colorado River negotiations, and can a Nevada-led stopgap help bring about compromise? Covering it all is Alan Halaly. He's the water reporter for the Las Vegas Review-Journal. Alan, welcome back.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Let's talk about this latest revision from the Bureau of Reclamation. When we started this water year back in October, forecasters predicted that water flow through the Colorado River would be about two-thirds of the historic average. Now it looks like it'll just be about 40% total over the entire year. Help me put that into perspective. How bad was this winter compared to others?
Yeah, it's been something that we've been watching closely. It feels like there's not a lot of good news along the river these days, but this year is going to set some records in terms of what we're seeing right now. You know, this mid-March projection that downgraded inflows into Lake Powell to about 27% of normal, that's the third lowest on record. And the only years that beat it are the ones that kind of started this 20-year drought cycle that we've been in. So it's dire conditions, and it's certainly turning up the heat when we're talking about delivering some sort of agreement that they haven't been able to come to the states these past, you know, 2-3 years.
This terrible winter has served as a backdrop to those ongoing negotiations. Of course, negotiators did not reach an agreement before a Department of the Interior imposed deadline last month. Now it appears the feds have released their own plans to divide the water if the states can't reach an agreement. What is that roadmap, and how are states responding?
Yeah, I mean, I think it became very clear when each of the seven states submitted official comments in the National Environmental Policy Act process that no state is entirely happy with what is on the table right now. There's what is called the basic coordination alternative, which is what the Bureau of Reclamation and Interior Department can do absent any agreement. And, you know, there's projections on there that show Lake Mead and Lake Powell going straight down in the next couple years. I mean, that's what the Bureau of Reclamation feels that it has the legal authority to do without an agreement from the states. So I don't think that any state is looking at that with, you know, rose-colored glasses. I think we've been seeing some states take a more offensive stance. Arizona, for instance, is going to get the short end of the stick if this goes forward. So I think that, you know, the risk isn't equalized across every state, but no state is happy with the state of affairs right now.
At the same time, Nevada's top negotiator, John Ensminger from the Southern Nevada Water Authority, Las Vegas Valley Water District, has put forward a stopgap measure that he thinks could buy the state some time. What's in that proposal?
Yeah, so it really focuses on what we call the upper initial units, these reservoirs that are above Lake Powell that have been typically left alone for upper basin use. But what this stopgap measure posits is that those would be the first line of defense to keep levels in Lake Powell high. You know, I spoke with John Ensminger, and he says the only purpose that Lake Powell serves is to keep those releases going. But we heard just this morning, I watched the Upper Colorado River Commission meeting where all of the upper basin states spoke, and what New Mexico's Commissioner Esteban Lopez said was they put a counter proposal on the table that they haven't heard back from. So Nevada's proposal kind of is reinvigorating the talks in the sense that they're looking toward just a 2-year agreement to keep things going in this really, really bad water year. And, you know, the upper basin states have not quite divulged what is in that counter proposal and what their hang up or problem is. But, you know, in the near term, it does look like the Bureau of Reclamation is eyeing water in one of those reservoirs, Flaming Gorge, to kind of keep those levels in Lake Powell high. Of course, there are concerns for power generation. There's concerns that is the infrastructure even good enough for us to have releases from Lake Powell this year? And that's a pretty scary thought. for us here in Southern Nevada. So this proposal is bringing them back to the table, but it doesn't seem like they're even really happy with that, even though it does kind of go around some of these longstanding issues, namely mandatory cuts for the upper basin states.
In the meantime, states are looking for new sources of water. Are there any projects that have caught your eye?
You know, there was just a memorandum of understanding signed with California, Arizona, and Nevada that's kind of looking at desalination from the Carlsbad plant in San Diego. So there are, you know, efforts being made to look at what we call water augmentation projects, adding more water to the system rather than just fighting over what's there. So that's something I'm keeping my eye on for sure. And I guess the other thing I would say is, you know, Nevada hasn't really been very public about how it's preparing for what could be a very long, costly court battle between the states that would almost certainly go to the Supreme Court. Just the other day, Arizona hired a outside counsel for the first time for a potential legal fight, and we haven't heard anything from Attorney General Ford or Governor Lombardo as to what our strategy looks like. I believe the direct quote from John Ensminger was, "Our strategy is to win." So we don't really know what is happening behind the scenes here in Nevada, but it certainly will be something to watch.
Alan Hilaly is the water reporter for the Las Vegas Review Journal. Alan, thank you so much.
Thanks.
One of the year's major sporting events is officially upon us, March Madness, the annual tournament of 68 college men's basketball teams. It's also a huge sports betting event each year. The tournament is expected to draw more than $3 billion in wagers, according to the American Gaming Association. That's largely thanks to the widespread proliferation of legal online sports betting and its legally distinct but practically identical cousin, online prediction markets. When the U.S. Supreme Court struck down the federal ban on sports betting in 2018, Americans legally wagered less than $5 billion on sports annually. Last year, they bet $150 billion. Of course, the thrill of a big win is exciting. However, when bet makers start to feel pressure and chase losses, it's no longer fun. And that, in and of itself, could be the first sign of a problem. And it appears a growing number of Americans are noticing they may have a problem. With me to talk about the impact problem gambling can have on individuals and communities is Alan Feldman. He's the Director of Strategic Initiatives with UNLV's International Gaming Institute. Also with us is Stephanie Goodman, Executive Director of the Dr. Robert Hunter International Problem Gambling Center. Alan, Stephanie, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Alan, what's the most alarming problem gaming trend you've seen of late?
Well, I think we all have a lot of reason to be very concerned about youth, not only in our community, in our state, but around the country. I think it's important to remember that even the numbers you just read may not be quite as accurate as the picture they paint. I think it's important to remember that we've had gambling in this country for hundreds of years, dating back to actually before the Revolution. So gambling has been part and parcel of our experience, not only in America, but worldwide. And the stats that you read about the amount of gambling going on, the FBI long suspected that illegal gambling was 7 to 10 times higher than legal gambling. So what we are seeing now is we're seeing it come out into the sunlight, which is a really good thing. The challenge, I think, and I suspect Stephanie is experiencing it more directly in a different way, but I think that the challenge is something that is legal doesn't necessarily mean something that should be done. And we haven't quite taught our young people that lesson. And I have a feeling that if you were to take a look at the number of people who are calling helplines for the first time or seeking out services for the first time, that the majority of them are going to be younger.
Stephanie, let me ask you then, you know, what are you seeing on the treatment side of things when it comes to these problem gambling trends?
Our largest growing population is 18 to 30 year olds. And 18, you're not even allowed to gamble. And that is where we're seeing them getting involved with the prediction markets as well. I think what we need to realize is these young men particularly have been groomed to participate in this sort of activity from their loot boxes on their video games, trying to get a skin, to then all of a sudden at 18, they're being marketed very heavily by prediction markets. And we're just seeing a real problem here. So it is it isn't our largest population yet, but it is our largest growing population. And what I can tell you is I think that we're looking at a public health issue here with our, especially with our young men.
Let's talk about online sports betting. It's now a $482 million a year industry in Nevada where it's allowed, provided you register at an actual Nevada casino and only bet within state limits. Of course, it increases the convenience and ease of betting on games. Alan, how much does this complicate responsible gaming efforts?
Well, I think that there's good and bad. It's a double-edged sword. Again, I want to remind you that you're talking about a question of legality, not a question of practice. The current basketball championship was designed as a gambling event from its get-go decades ago. Many of the sports that we love and enjoy have had gambling going on. I remember I spoke to one FBI agent years ago who said that there was probably more gambling going on inside any given NBA arena on any night than there was in the entire state of Nevada. So we shouldn't, you know, we shouldn't try to believe that this is like shocking and all of a sudden. What is sudden is it's become legal suddenly, and it's now out in the open suddenly. And we haven't prepared as a community, as a state, as a nation, we haven't prepared the necessary educational tools in order to teach people how this works and how it should work for many, many people. They learn from their parents. They learn from their parents how to bet on games. Their first bets were frequently with their parents, which was in its own way encouraging something, but they, you know, it was out of naivete. They didn't realize. And now you add, you know, to someone who started betting when they were 13 or 14 with their parents, and now you add the accessibility to it. Now they're 20 years old, and whether they can bet legally or not is questionable depending on where they are and how they do it. But do they really understand the nuance of this and, frankly, the prospective danger of it? And I think the answer has been made clear to us. It's no.
Stephanie, you know, piggybacking off that, how do you teach somebody, especially if it's a family tradition, how do you teach personal limits when it comes to gaming in general, gambling in general, not just online gambling?
Well, I think we need to also recognize that, you know, 90% of the population can have a good time and set limits and be able to gamble accordingly, right? So there's that. And when we're talking about, especially when what Alan was saying with our youth, there is a normalization, I think, that, and I think that's the real issue here, is that you know, we had kids graduation parties, and they were, you know, it was a gaming party, and no one thought anything of it. And I think the real issue here is we've got to get into those schools, and we've got to, you know, they talk about everything else in school. They talk about drug addiction. They talk about alcohol. They're not talking about gambling. And so we need to make sure that that's part of that curriculum. As they're coming up K through 12, they understand that there are dangers here. And if I'm too preoccupied with this, maybe I should take a step back. Ideally, you don't want to have someone come to us in treatment when they're 8 or 9 severity on a 1 to 10 scale. We'd love for them at, you know, 1 to 2 to realize, oh, wait, maybe there might be an issue here. Maybe I should talk to somebody. There's, you know, this addiction is so devastating. People lose everything in their lives. And it's not just money. It's their families. It's their loved ones. And oftentimes it's their own life, because suicidality is highest among those with a gambling addiction. So I think it's this awareness piece that we really need to do a lot better on. And it's we're getting in on the ground floor with some people here that put SB 165. Senator Wynn did some incredible work there. And we're getting in on the ground floor to make sure gambling is covered in all of this. Because so often you can go through and get your entire degree and you have never taken a course on gambling addiction. Your entire degree in psychology, never a course in gambling addiction. And keep in mind, just this quick statistic, 10% of adolescents have placed a bet. 10%. And out of that 10%, we think that there's 26% of those that may have a problem. And that is significantly higher than the nationwide average of what we think is a 6% average.
Well, let me ask you, what is the first sign that somebody may have a problem?
It is the being preoccupied with the gambling. Oftentimes, if you get that dopamine hit and you get a big win, and suddenly you want to get that again, you want to get that again. And that's a lot of times that's what triggers it. You know, if you look at a brain under an fMRI, it has the same kind of reaction when you have that win in gambling as someone who's doing drugs or drinking. And so that is really, you know, that's the real issue there is this is it's a serious addiction.
I want to add to an individual, if you've tried to stop, if you've tried to cut back and you can't, talk to someone. Whether you're calling someone at Stephanie's place of work or you're talking to your spouse, a loved one, a brother, a sister, you know, a parent, whomever it is, not being able to stop or cut back is a sign that something's up. And you just need to figure out what it is. It does not necessarily mean that you are addicted. It just means, you know, if you've on your own made that decision to cut back and you can't, seek some help.
And if I may, there is a lot of stigma that's attached to gambling addiction. And oftentimes people don't want to talk about it. And that's really what we're trying to get out there and say, this is a biological disorder that lives in the same part of the brain as alcohol and drugs. So you're not weak. You know, oftentimes, well, just don't go to the casino. You're not capable of doing that. And now, guess what? It's not even going to the casino. It's going on your phone. So we have this incredibly addictive behavior that is now on an incredibly addictive device. And so we are really, we have a problem. It's a serious problem. And that's why you should just talk about it. If you think, all of a sudden, I'm thinking about betting. I'm thinking, and how about this? I'm not thinking about who's going to win the game. I'm thinking about what in-game bets I can do on a prediction market or what in-game bets I can do so that I can keep this action going. So that's a lot. That's a lot of things that are red flags for individuals.
I want to touch on prediction markets for just one second. You know, just to clarify, it's where people can go online, find a sporting event or maybe the outcome of what's going to happen in Congress, and they can essentially put a wager on that. You know, it is legally distinct. They say that they are contracts instead of wagers. So I'm curious, do gamblers recognize prediction markets as gambling, Alan?
Well, before we even go to that length, does your brain recognize the difference? Because whether or not you are able to come up with this pretzel-like legal distinction between them, I will guarantee you your brain does not make that distinction. Your brain is getting the enjoyment out of putting something at risk for an uncertain outcome in order to get something of greater value. And that's what it is. And who regulates it and how we define it legally is a wonderful intellectual exercise, but has nothing to do with the neurology of the human brain.
So talk to me about what, you know, centers like yours, Stephanie, the National Center for Responsible Gaming, what can be done to begin to address this growing, as you called it, public health crisis?
Well, I thought you were going to talk to me about prediction markets because I was ready to just jump in on that one in. Because let me tell you, before I hit that, though, I do want to just piggyback on what Alan had said with the prediction markets. Again, it's the normalization, right? So you're on Robinhood and you're trading stocks that are legitimate and you think you're doing something good because you're investing, but right next to you is the Kalshi trade on the game tonight. So, you know, it's that kind of stuff that's nuts. But when it comes back to how do we make this better? Here's the thing, as Alan had said, even though we've had in 2025, for instance, one prediction market, $27 million traded, quote unquote, on Kalshi. This year, $867 million traded on Kalshi. So we are seeing a huge increase. We also need to realize that it's legal, quote unquote. It's in the courts and we're trying to fix it. But here's the thing. As we move forward, we've got to start talking about it. And I think that is the biggest issue. No one talks about gambling gambling as a legitimate addiction, and it is. And I think that now that we have it available in so many different mediums, we have to start. What we're going to see happen is another opioid crisis. I mean, it's going to be the exact same thing. And we need to start 10 years from now, we're going to say, oh, wow, who knew? We know right now, and we need to do something. And what we need to do is have ad campaigns out there. You know, I'm going to date myself, but this is your brain on drugs kind of ad campaign that's running nationally that lets these individuals know and lets parents know, hey, this is, keep your eye open because this could be a problem. And I think that's all we can do is really up that awareness by 1,000%, because right now no one thinks that gambling is a problem, or a very small percentage. And I think we're suddenly starting to find out, because every time I tell someone what I do, they either have a loved one or a friend or someone that they know that says, gosh, I should give you so-and-so's name.
Alan, you had a long career in the gaming industry, which you've talked about on this program before. From where you sit, have casinos, these gaming, online gaming companies, have they done enough or really anything to improve responsible gaming measures over your career?
Well, I think it's always important to remember that the industry is not a monolith. It is made up of hundreds of different companies of varying sizes. So there isn't an answer for everyone. What I can tell you is that certainly the bigger companies have made significant efforts in this. There's always room to improve, and we're always learning new things on a regular basis. But I would say that there's more engagement on this topic generally in the industry than at any time in the past. Now, that said, we've got a lot of licensees in Nevada who could quite honestly be doing more. Everyone is required by law to put up some signs. Everyone is required by law to have information available, to do training. But what does that actually mean? You know, what is the training? Are they passing out a Xerox sheet and say, read this and sign at the bottom and turn it in? Or are they really getting engaged and trying to help their own employees help their own customers? It's good for business. It's just that simple. But I think that things at the moment in Nevada are inconsistent. Those that are engaged and really putting effort into this are really doing some wonderful things. And again, we can all learn from each other going forward. We're nowhere near to cracking the code on this, but we're certainly in a much better place than we were 30 years ago when I first started within the industry talking about this.
What kind of benchmark would you like to see the industry reach that would show meaningful change in gambling addiction?
Well, I suppose the answer is it's to be determined. One of the things that would be nice is to actually have access to customer data and to company practice so that we can benchmark this. You know, at the moment, we have an idea of what best practices look like, or at least we think they do, but no one has really had the ability to go in and analyze the impact on actual customer data. Most of it ends up being analyzed on very small sample sizes in labs, not only at UNLV, but in other places around the United States and around the world. So I don't know that we have a benchmark yet. I think we'd like to get there. And that also leads to one of the glaring problems in Nevada, which is we haven't done a lot of prevalence study, community study in 30 years. It would be nice to get to that.
Stephanie, we have about 30 seconds left. You know, what would you like to see on the policy side of things? You know, what sort of benchmarks?
Well, here's the thing. When we implement too much policy, we essentially push people off to the illegal markets. And so for me, I think that everyone, there needs to be benchmarks, but it's a very delicate dance here. So either they get zero protections with nothing, or we're doing what we're doing right now, and we're trying to make sure that people have these tools so that they can at least get some help. Again, I'll leave it with, we have to go back to the awareness piece. If we do not start talking about this with middle schoolers, we're in trouble.
That is Stephanie Goodman, Executive Director of the Dr. Robert Hunter International Problem Gambling Center. Also with us, Alan Fellman, Director of Strategic Initiatives with the UNLV International Gaming Institute. And if you or somebody you know has a gambling problem, you can find more resources at 1-800-GAMBLER. That's 1-800-GAMBLER. This is KNPR State of Nevada. From makeshift stages in the desert to people's living rooms to the back rooms of record stores, Las Vegas musicians have always found places to play. The redevelopment of downtown Las Vegas, especially in the Arts District, has seen several new music venues come on board. Sadly, many of them have shuttered over the last 2 years. And yet, it seems that in line with Las Vegas tradition, a new crop of venues has suddenly taken their place. Meanwhile, the city keeps churning out new young talent eager to make a name for themselves on those new stages. Keeping an eye on all these things are music writers Amber Sampson, arts and entertainment editor of the Las Vegas Weekly, and Gab Rodriguez, staff writer at the same magazine. KNPR's Mike Pravat spoke to them recently. Here's that conversation.
Amber and Gab, welcome back to State of Nevada.
Hi, thanks for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for coming in. It has been a minute since we have caught up with the local music scene. Let's start with an aspect that reflects how Las Vegas acts connect with and grow their fan bases, and that's live music venues. Many of them are in downtown, and I think there are people out there that are confused about the status and future of one of the more central venues, and that's Swan Dive. Gab, I wonder if you can fill us in. Why did Swan Dive close and then become something else, and then make plans to reappear elsewhere?
All right, so to just put it simply, Harvey Graham came in from Texas / Portland, and he has two other venues out there. He wanted to bring Swan Dive to Las Vegas as a secondary venue to him, because he's also the owner of Oddfellows, too. I think that the space that he decided to take on at the Colorado is a little bit bigger than what he originally anticipated. And while it was working out for the most part, once the original space of Syndwave opened up down the street, he decided to take that on into a smaller scale venture, which left the space at the Colorado open for Tim Cam, who was the managing partner at Swan Dive, to make it his own concept. So that is today sitting as Bazaar Bar, and it's currently being renovated by Tim Cam and his team. That deadline has been pushed a little bit farther down the line. So these shows that you're seeing pop up to be scheduled at Bazaar Bar or Swan Dive or one or the other are being tossed off to other venues downtown like Fremont Country Club or Triple B's or The Usual Place, who are kind of just picking up that slack.
That is a tale as old as time. Now, Amber, let's move down the block from Swan Dive. Now, while that venue was closed, another music sprouted up, and that's Dustland Bar. That opened last July, and it has an outdoor stage. Now, how has that venue filled the void left by others that have also closed in the area?
That's a great question, because honestly, I'll be honest, I have been waiting for Dustland Bar to open. I know, you know, just going back really quickly to Swan Dive, people kind of were hoping that that would be like Bunkhouse Saloon 2.0. But I'll be honest with you, Mike, like when I walked into Dustland Bar, it did give me insane Bunkhouse vibes. The bar is incredible, just the gathering space in general. But when you go out to the back, there's this beautiful stage out there. It's really large, and they've already kind of had some really great acts coming into town, a lot of touring acts. And I also know that local singer B. Rose is actually working with Dustland on some bookings and events managing. So we have a lot of good stuff, I think, in the pipeline for that venue.
You know, Amber, in general, live music downtown has gone through a lot of transition over the last few years, as you well know. We had the downtown version of the Sand Dollar Lounge close in December. The alternative music spot Synwave, which Gab just mentioned, that closed a year ago this month. And almost exactly 2 years ago, Artifice, which occasionally featured live bands, they shuttered to make way for the Doberman Lounge. You know, Amber, why do you think there have been so many venue closures and transitions in that area, which seems like it would be a great venue to have live music?
Well, first of all, I just want to say it hurts my heart when Sand Dollar Downtown closed, because I've been there for a bunch of shows and a lot of them were local shows. It had a great stage. There was no cover. It was in a casino. So it really felt kind of like a step up, I think, for local bands who don't necessarily get that opportunity. And, you know, it's sad. It's sad to see a lot of these great venues close. I think part of it comes down to rents are too high downtown. I think that's a huge part of it. I know that was a factor into why Synwave closed. I think a part of it, too, is the engagement from the local audience. I've heard from some promoters who've said, like, we had a great booking and barely anybody showed up. So I think maybe we have a problem, a little bit of support from the locals.
You know, meanwhile, Gab, Backstage Bar and Billiards, the Griffin, Ferguson's Downtown, the Usual Place, these are all in the Fremont East District. They all book local acts. They seem to have pretty busy calendars. What do you think they're doing right? Or is maybe, does it have something to do with the area?
I think both of those things play a huge part into the kind of audiences that they're able to gather in those venues. I mean, Pulsar Presents and Smash Magazine do an incredible job of getting these really huge names that audiences and fans just want to get out and see. And it does help that their favorite bars are down the street from the venue where they can pregame and hang out or postgame after the shows. And also, I think 21 plus shows are also just going to be a hit because sometimes the older people in the fan groups don't want to hang around an all age show. And I get that, you know, there's a give and take there.
Jumping off your point there, Gabby, I do feel like all ages, like younger listeners, like younger local live music listeners, they are the ones who do support the most, in my opinion. At all ages shows, like, those kids, like, show up. I feel like that gives me a little bit of hope.
I wonder what you're hearing from the bands. You know, getting gigs is very important. This is, a lot of them, how they're making any money. They're certainly, you know, not getting it from streaming. What are they telling you when you are interviewing them as far as getting gigs, the quality of the gigs? Like, what's the temperature you're gauging from them?
It's hard. It's hard to be a local live musician, but all at the same time, I think that they're trying to play as many shows as they can to make up for that gap. But also, it's been really exciting, I think, to see some local bands get the opportunity to, like, open for really big bands. You know, those type of opportunities are huge. So I feel like it's kind of like a circle, I want to say. They have to play a crap ton of shows and then hope to maybe get picked up on a larger bill, and that kind of catapults them to maybe hopefully going out of the state to do some touring, but that's also a little risky too, so.
Well, that seems like a good transition point to talk about the acts themselves. Gab, you wanted to discuss the hardcore act Roman Candle. What drew you to this band?
Roman Candle has been around since about 2022. I think they came out with their first album in 2023. Piper Ferrari is such a force in the local music scene. I mean, even when she was in her former band, So Without, she has this, like, dominating and ferocious personality on and off stage. And she's just an incredibly talented person in the scene.
Gab, I also want to bring up an act that you featured online in the March 19th edition of The Weekly, Snow the Product. She's a Latina, bilingual, queer MC, and she just had a gig at, speaking of, House of Blues on March 21st. What does Snow rap about?
She's one of those artists that is unabashedly politically inclined. She really wants to make it known what her standpoint is on in the government and how she feels about underrepresented communities within the Latino culture, and especially being a queer woman and bilingual. She's from the Bay too. She's, you know, not afraid to speak up about the issues that are, you know, brewing in her background. While she, at the same time, she is a very political person, she's also just good to throw on in a party and, you know, enjoy her bars.
All right, Amber, let's talk about who you are listening to right now, including R&B singer Ayaka Taylor. Now, you write that she's new to the scene here. So what is her story and why did you want to share it with your readers?
Well, so basically her story is really interesting. She actually started as a model. And she's a really sweet girl, but she also is an incredible, incredible R&B singer. She has a beautiful vocals, very velvety, very warm. The first time I heard her earlier this year, I was kind of just blown away. And originally, I had just interviewed her because Beyonce was coming to town, and I had heard she was really heavily influenced by Destiny's Child and Beyonce. And then, you know, once I started listening to her music, you know, her song Waves that came out in December, it's just glossy and just gorgeous. So I was really taken aback by her, almost kind of like, who is this, you know, hidden gem that's been here in the scene that I didn't even know about?
You have also been following the local MC singer Quinn Ayers. You seem drawn to these multifaceted personalities in local music. Akaya, as you mentioned, is a model and actress, and Quinn is a former baseball player. So why did he venture from the baseball diamond to the recording studio?
Basically, I found out while he was playing college baseball, he had been writing, you know, in a journal, just writing. And he got to the point where he wanted to start writing his own music. So I found out between, like, baseball practices, he would go into his dorm and literally just be writing songs. And eventually he realized, like, hey, I actually love this more than playing. So he decided to pursue it. And ever since then, he's been just dropping music left and right. He has a really confessional songwriting style. His latest album, Run It Back, it has like hyperpop, R&B, straight up rap. There's all kinds of variety there and flavor. And he seems to really enjoy just music in general. And the production's always really tight.
You threw me into the shadow. I did what any sane person would do. Fill in the spaces with my goals. Give me a reason why I should trust.
We're going to have to leave it there. Amber Sampson is the arts entertainment editor of Las Vegas Weekly, and Gab Rodriguez is a staff writer at the magazine as well. Amber and Gab, thanks so much for speaking with me.
Thank you.
There's no shortage of what to see, hear, and do at any time in Nevada. Back to talk about a few of the best options is KNPR's Mike Brevet, who oversees the Arts and Culture Beat for Nevada Public Radio. Hi, Mike.
Hey, Paul.
I know you like to talk about revered, under-the-radar music acts, and I know you've got one for us.
Yeah, and his name is Pasquale Grasso. He is a jazz guitarist, and I would say he's probably your favorite jazz guitarist's favorite jazz guitarist, if all the kudos that I have read about him are any indication. In any event, he is playing Myron's at the Smith Center on Friday, March 27th. And what's unique about Grasso is that he tackles the guitar like it's a piano. So instead of playing in the fashion of like Wes Montgomery, a famous guitarist, he actually takes primary inspiration from Bud Powell, a famous jazz pianist and composer, and some other bebop pioneers that also did not play guitar as well.
So what is it about the piano that he finds so inspiring?
I think it's the arrangements. He would hear these records by Powell and another bebop piano great, Art Tatum, and then he would try to figure out how those recordings sounded the way that they did, where certain instruments were placed. In the case of Tatum, he said it sounded like two pianos, not one. So he would apply all of his discoveries, hearing this other music, to his own playing, and then later combined his classical guitar influence to form his sound. So he's won a bunch of awards for his work, including a Grammy working on the debut record for Samara Joy. She is a jazz vocalist who herself will perform at the Smith Center in a few weeks.
I know a lot of our listeners would be excited to see some great jazz come to Las Vegas. Now we're going to talk about other people talking. Looks like there's another Black Mountain Institute live conversation happening.
Yeah, some of you might have heard last weekend's BMI Conversations interview with BMI Kluge Fellow and writer-poet Saretta Morgan by Nevada Public Radio's Heidi Kaiser. And if you wanted to hear more from Saretta, you've got a great opportunity on Friday, March 27th at the West Las Vegas Library. Saretta is leading a panel called Nature is What We Come to in the Practice of Remembering.
That feels like a lot.
Well, to your point, this conversation will cover and combine three topics: ecology, sociology, and memory. I take that to mean this is going to largely tie the Black experience and social justice to the natural world. And in expressing that, the panelists will use songs, accounts, photos, and other outlets for recording, preserving culture and history. And before you ask, those panelists include the director of UNLV's Oral History Research Center, Clay T. White, local writer-educator Erica Vital-Lazar, and from New Mexico, artist-performer Lazarus Letcher. So a nice intellectual appetizer for your weekend.
And for your final recommendation, we got sports, but not baseball, which is starting this week. No, it looks like Saturday, March 28th is the Las Vegas Lights home opener.
That's right. The Lights season has already begun. There are already two losses in the hole, along with a draw in their standings. So it would be nice to score their first 2026 win at home. And we don't want this season to look like last season, where the Lights finished last in their United Soccer League division.
Have they done anything in the offseason to spruce up the team?
Yeah, most notably, they have a new head coach. His name is Devin Rensing, and he's been successful coaching college teams, and he's already been an assistant coach for a couple USL teams. And they've added some new players per a report from the Las Vegas Sun. Among them, it signed forward Ben Mines, who has some experience in both the majors and winning a USL championship. As for the home part, if you've got any affection for Cashman Field, you better catch a game this year, because after the season's finished, that stadium is coming down in exchange for about 1,000 new homes.
Which means the Lights will be looking for a new home ahead of the 2027 season.
Indeed.
We're going to have to leave it there, Mike. As always, thank you.
Thank you.